Welcome to Limitless, the Bland Beginnings podcast where seeing things differently inspires limitless possibilities. This podcast is being brought to you by Blind Beginnings, an organization based in Vancouver, Canada, that supports children and youth who are blind or partially sighted, along with their families. Limitless was created in order to inform, educate, entertain, and share stories from within the blind and partially sighted community, in order to show the world that the opportunities for those who are blind or partially sighted are truly limitless. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce you to your host, the executive director and founder of Blind Beginnings, Sean Marcellet.
Welcome back to Limitless, the Blind Beginnings podcast. I'm your host, Sean Marcellet, and thank you for joining us again this week. My co-host today is Ishita. Welcome back to the podcast, Ishita.
Thank you for having me.
Can you remind our listeners a little bit about your vision?
Right. So I am partially sighted. I have a condition called cone rod dystrophy, which primarily affects my central field of vision. So I can see general colors and general shapes, but I have trouble with seeing finer details.
And today we have a guest all the way from the other side of Canada, Nova Scotia, Jenny Bovart. Welcome, Jenny.
Hello. So happy to be here.
Yeah, it's really awesome to have you here. Jenny and I were on an advocacy committee together years ago, and I haven't really been able to catch up with you since you left BC and went to the other side. How have things been?
Well, it's been good to be closer to family, and I do miss the West Coast at times, but yeah, it's been good to sort of be here close to family, and I've been here a while now, so it feels like home.
So Jenny also has a podcast, which we won't give all the goods away right away, but can you, before we kind of get to know you a little bit better, can you describe your vision for our listeners?
Certainly. I live with albinism, and with albinism comes what I identify as low vision. And albinism is a congenital condition, so I was born with it. And for me, it's just the way I live my life. It's just normal to me. But for a better understanding, my visual acuity without my glasses would be something like 20 over 400. So what someone with really great vision sees well from 400 feet away, I would have to be 20 feet away to see it at the same sort of level of detail. Along with albinism comes really extreme light sensitivity called photophobia. And so that puts me in some compromising situations depending on the lighting, whether it's outside in the sun or even just everyday lighting sometimes is a real struggle to deal with. And so one last big thing that I personally deal with albinism is no depth perception. So throughout my life and lots of great vision loss rehabilitation, I've been able to fly under the radar at a lot of the times, and it's sometimes surprising to people when I tell them that I live with low vision or that I'm legally blind and that kind of thing.
So you don't use a white cane, or you know, you can kind of get around without people really knowing.
This is true. Although there are times when I think to myself, I should really have a white cane right now. It would really come in handy. But yes, I tend to fly under the radar. The hat and sunglasses sometimes either makes me look like a celebrity or makes people ask questions about my vision. So I find myself in some situations describing my vision and trying to help someone understand that I'm not being rude. I didn't cut in front of you in line on purpose. I really didn't see you there.
Mm-hmm. Can you relate to that, Ishita?
I can, 100%. So my vision is 20 over 500. I don't have glasses to correct it. It just doesn't get corrected. And there have been several instances of where people think I'm rude. And I actually had someone at work, after I explained that I had a visual impairment, come up to me and say, "Oh, you're visually impaired. I thought you were just rude and hated everyone because I don't look anyone in the eye." And I said, right. No, that's not the case. because my central vision is affected, I look to the side a lot. So to them, it looks like I'm looking to the right. You know, I'm trying to look straight, but that's not how it looks to them. So I always get mistaken for being rude or looking somewhere else, and people, you know, snap their fingers in front of me, kind of like a dog. And it's a little embarrassing and a little humiliating when they do it in public. But I can absolutely relate to what you were saying, Jenny.
That's super relatable for me too. And I totally didn't even mention, I'm really fortunate that with glasses, with correction in really perfect lighting, my visual acuity is much improved. It's around 20 over 200. So I am really fortunate. A lot of folks with albinism don't even have that option.
Yeah. So for myself, having like a degenerative eye condition, there was a period in my life where I was navigating the world kind of in between, right? That like I have retinitis pigmentosa, so my central vision was pretty good. I could read. I could make eye contact with people once I found their eyes. But, and I could make the choice to use a white cane or not. I probably should have been using it much sooner than I was, but I totally can relate to what that's like. And in some ways, I almost feel like it got easier when I lost more vision, ironically, because once the choice was taken away and you have that white cane to just like tell people, you don't have to explain so much. Like that must be exhausting at times, having to explain all the time.
It can be. And, you know, I do have an ID cane, an identification cane that I carry around with me in certain situations. If I go to a concert, I'll bring it with me. Or if I know if I'm going to be in a really busy, unfamiliar place. But another thing I do is I wear a button that says low vision and it has a checkered eye on it. So it's helpful in those situations where I'm asking for help and I don't want to have a big, long conversation about the whole thing. I can kind of hopefully just point to it and hopefully they will clue in.
And do people recognize that and understand what it means?
It's a good question. I don't know. I don't know that I've really truly seen it in action. I think I've been in a few situations where, again, I've just been asking for assistance. And sometimes you have to really convince someone that you need help. They think that you're just being needy. Could you tell me all of the flavors, please, that I can get in my coffee? Because I really would like to make an educated choice. And you don't want to have a big, long conversation about it. So I've tried to, on a few occasions, I'll point to the button and say, you know, I have low vision. You know, I'm not trying to be a pain. And I think they're more willing to comply.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little more about yourself. What's a day in the life of Jenny like?
Well, I have a lot of different hobbies. I really like to stay busy. I think it keeps me out of trouble. I work by day with CNIB. I've been with them for a little over 7 years now. And I also have been working with Accessible Media in different projects, different facets for a little over 7 years as well. So that's been a really great opportunity to have that creative outlet and really put to work what I went to college for, which I never really thought could happen. I'm really sort of delightfully surprised that I've had all those opportunities to work in media and broadcasting. So that's been really great. I also like to run. I'm really hooked on running. Another thing that I never really thought would come about for me, didn't really get physically active, start playing gold ball or doing any of that kind of thing until my mid-20s. So kind of late in life for a lot of people. I like to volunteer with Blind Sports Nova Scotia as well. I help run the Tandem Bike Club. Love putting other people's butts on tandem bikes. Hashtag butts on bikes is my favorite hashtag right now and has been for a while. I have a lot of different hobbies. I like to eat and bake and spend time with my friends. And from time to time, opportunities to advocate and get involved with projects to bring about change come up as well. And I have a hard time saying no. So I get involved with little things like that along the way too.
I can relate to the have trouble saying no. Well, let's talk about the podcast. What is your podcast called? What's it about? You could describe it better than I can, I'm sure.
All right, so let me tell you a little bit about low vision moments. Low vision moments is my, it is my most favorite project ever that I've had the chance to do. It's something I've been plotting for a really long time. For years, I've been talking about telling these little low vision moments stories that I've been collecting along the way. And honestly, I've been trying to make people laugh forever, for like as long as I can remember. So I've been keeping these anecdotes in my brain, and then I started writing them down many years ago. And then the opportunity came about Accessible Media, AMI Audio. They were looking for pitches for podcasts. And I was like, yes, podcasts. This is the most inherently accessible medium when you have low vision or blindness, or you live with any kind of vision loss. It just lends itself so well. And so I was like, now is my opportunity to try and make people laugh, share my funny little stories. I hope other people find them funny, and maybe raise a little bit of awareness at the same time. So I really wanted to share stories that not only people who are living with vision loss or low vision or blindness or whatever your preferred terminology might be. I say that all the time because I don't really identify with partial sight or vision loss. I've lived with low vision my whole life. So that's just me.
Yeah.
But I want to tell relatable, funny stories so we can laugh together and just have a fun conversation. And the awareness piece is for listeners who may not have a personal connection to blindness or vision loss or albinism, and sort of just bring them into our world and let them see that blindness, number one, is a huge spectrum. Even two people with the same eye condition, we don't have the same life experience. We don't see the same thing necessarily, and we don't go about our day the same way. But there are often those relatable aspects. And then for the listeners that, again, that don't have a personal connection, we're just everyday people. I need them to know that we're just like you. We want to have a good laugh at ourselves from time to time. And, you know, there's the awareness piece of, you know, I'm not being a jerk. Maybe consider that I didn't see you there, or maybe consider that there's something going on to make someone look like they're doing something a little bit differently than you would expect them to do it. And so the opportunity with AMI came up, and I was like, yes, let's do this, please. I've been plotting this forever. And it's been such an awesome way to, number one, meet people that I've always wanted to meet and have discussions with. And two, apparently people are finding the stories funny. So that was one of my things, is like, are other people really going to enjoy this? And so far, so good.
Yeah, I totally. I mean, we have such similar goals with our podcast too. It is to raise awareness and just show that we're just people, right? All different experiences and different levels of vision, but we're just all humans first. So I love that.
And then you have those moments that you're like, you're just trying to go about your day, and it's like, oh crap, there's that reminder that I don't see well. And here's something I have to deal with. I can either get mad about it or embarrassed.
Yeah.
And you might be mad or embarrassed in the moment, but later on it might be funny.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I love the sort of let's laugh at ourselves. I mean, it makes everybody more comfortable with what's going on too.
I think so. It helps me anyway. It's been a cathartic experience in some ways too, especially in the most recent episode where I talk about growing up with albinism and vision loss. Like I said, it's not always funny in the moment. Mm-hmm. Frankly, it was embarrassing a lot of the time, and I was just trying to hide any visual impairment that I had. Just wanted to be like every other kid. But later on, you look back and reflect, and you're like, well, that was really a learning lesson. You know, that was a life lesson rather, and a learning experience. And it's actually pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
I love the title, first of all, Low Vision Moments. I think that's awesome because I have so many of those myself. You got one listener right here, I can tell you that. I'm very excited to hear it. But also just the message that you have, like Sean was saying, it's so similar, I think, to what Blind Beginnings does. And I really love that. And I try myself to not get, you know, in the moment, maybe if I have a low vision moment and I can be embarrassed and you know, whatever. But I try to laugh it off, and I try to make a lot of jokes with it, because I want the people that I'm around to see that it's normal. It's a part of my life, and it's okay to laugh. Like the way that I say it is, if you can laugh at my blind jokes, I think you're a true friend. That's how I judge my friendship. So I really relate to what you're saying.
And that's such a big part of it, is helping the people around you feel comfortable with what's going on, because and that's the demystifying piece that I'm trying to achieve. And it's a delicate thing to do, because we want to be included in the satire and in the joke, and there's a fine line between, you know, making fun of the situation or putting a negative, ugly spin on it. And when we're involved in the satire and we're making the joke and inviting you to laugh with us, it's that much more powerful and impactful, because I don't know, we're having this laugh together. It's not one person poking fun at the other person.
That is an interesting point, because I have had people in my life who make the blind jokes at me, or, you know, with me or about me in my presence. And that's kind of different, isn't it?
I think it is. And I think context is everything. It's all about the context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there's kind of a level of, okay, you're cool with me being blind, which is cool, like you're comfortable enough that you're making a joke. But I can think of one person in my life who pretty much every comment when I'm around ends up being about my blindness, and that can get a little bit much. It's kind of like, okay, can we move on now from this? I'm also a lot of other things and blind. So right. It's just interesting balance of like, yeah, if I'm the person living with the experience and I'm making a joke about it, I'm entitled to do that. But somebody else making the joke over and over has a different impact.
And let's not make a point to bring it up. Like, low vision moments, those are my things that happen to me in my day to day when I'm just trying to go about my day. It's the things that just happen. We're not looking for jokes and, you know, and things to make fun of. It's mm-hmm. They just happen, and you have to go with it. You have to choose a way to deal with it.
Yeah. So how has it been received so far?
Reception, from what I've seen, has all been positive. I'm really pleasantly surprised. I really didn't know how, I didn't know how the comedy piece would go. I know that people would be open to the story time and the awareness, but I wanted to make a podcast that I didn't see out there. And that's the comedy part. I love stand-up comedy. I love like sketch comedy. And I want to be included in that. I want to see more comedians with disabilities and that representation. We just want to be included in that world as well, I think. And this is my attempt at that. And I'm, again, just really pleasantly surprised with everyone that I talk to. It's been positive feedback. It's possible there's been less than positive feedback, but it hasn't come my way yet. I'm always, of course, open to constructive criticism. I'm always looking for ways to make the show more entertaining, make the podcast more entertaining or relatable. But it's so far been really good, and I hope to keep making many more episodes.
And when you reach out to guests to ask them to join you, are they excited to talk about this? Is this something that people are, you know, keen to share their moments as well?
Yes, I have handpicked certain people who I've either observed online, not to be creepy, but, you know, people that I've been following and admiring online for a while because we have something in common, like Jennifer Renee, my first guest. She's the first beauty influencer that I know of, that anyone knows of, that has albinism. Mm. And so she's kind of a big deal online. And So I really admired her, and she was quick to respond and eager to share her stories. And for her, I had seen a post from her on Facebook, and I was like, that's a low vision moment. That's something that happens to me. Yeah. People think that I'm that one person with albinism that they met. We need to talk. And every guest from there has just been such an easy, painless process. I can't say enough positive things about it. It's just been easy and natural, and I might be jinxing myself. but yeah, everyone's been awesome and keen to share. And like I said, the most recent episode has been really cathartic. And both the guest, Dennis Hurley, and I, he's a fantastic actor and comedian. At the end, we were both like, wow, I feel so much lighter now. I feel like I should pay you $100 for this therapy session. It's been great, but it was fun at the same time.
That's so cool. I know when we were talking about starting this podcast, we initially, even actually in the first episode, the episode is about it's about starting the podcast. And we talked about how we're going to release an episode every 2 weeks, except we never did that. It's been weekly and right now I think we've got like 4 recordings done that are ready to go for the next month, right? Like it's just snowballing. It's so amazing. I've caught the bug. I love the podcasting thing too.
It's the best medium. And you, with this podcast, I can't believe you're able to put one out every week.
Yeah.
That's amazing. The amount of work that goes into that, the dedication is that's impressive. But you have so many engaging people and so much to talk about. I'm not surprised at the same time.
I'm just curious, and this is kind of taking us in a different direction, but the reaction to low vision or even the interruptions in your daily goings about, is there a difference on the East Coast from the West Coast since you've lived in both places?
I never thought about that.
Yeah, I'm just curious if there's a greater awareness on one side of the country from the other about blindness and visual impairment, or...
I will say when I moved from... So I'm from New Brunswick. I went to college in Ontario. I lived in Alberta for a brief stint, and then I lived in BC for a handful of years. And then I came out back out west, and now I've been in Nova Scotia for about a decade now. I will say that when I first went out to Ontario, I did not notice a big difference. But when I got to Vancouver, I noticed that there were a few things that were just more accessible. The buses and public transportation announcing the stops was new to me. And I was like, holy, this makes my life so much easier. Why are we not doing this everywhere? And so I was there for a handful of years in Vancouver. So I had that experience. I got really used to that. And I got used to the really good signage. They have that great high contrast signage for public transportation, which is like a big part of life mm-hmm. when they don't let you drive. So it was a big deal. And then I came back east, back to Halifax, and it's a brand new city. I hadn't lived here before. I was lost all the time. I got lost on the way to so many job interviews when I first moved here, and it was so frustrating, all because the public transportation wasn't announcing the stops. So I had to go back to so much more planning and orientation and mobility type work that I wasn't used to doing. But in terms of people are the same everywhere. And quite frankly, they're not any better in one area of the country, I don't think, compared to another. Now that I think on it and ramble on it a little bit, I don't think it's much different in terms of people's reactions.
Yeah.
Sort of related to that, I'm kind of curious what your move itself, like the process of moving to different cities, was like as a person with low vision.
Well, that's a good question. I'll tell you, I moved around looking for a place that felt right, and just really like looking for my place in the world, somewhere that felt like home. I had reasons for going to all those different places, and I think like most things in life, when you live with any kind of disability, there's just a lot more planning involved, a lot more planning and preparation. And I think part of my personality that helps me with that kind of thing is picking up and going somewhere else as it might appear. There really is a lot of planning involved. I'm okay with the unknown and just kind of like, yep, if it doesn't work, I can say I tried. If I fall flat on my face or if I get lost, at least I tried. It makes me think of one time I was in the process of moving back east, and I had to take a flight, and it was one of those smaller planes with, I won't say the airline, I was about to, but I won't. It was a smaller plane, and I was flying alone, and I made arrangements ahead of time because I knew when they had these tiny little planes, I recognized the model. It was one that you have to walk out on the tarmac to get to the stairs that go up to the plane. You don't walk right through that like gateway thing right from the airport. So you had to go outside and be on the tarmac, which is something I'm not comfortable doing by myself because those flights, aren't usually a lot of people on them either. I think it was something like a Toronto to Ottawa flight, like something really short, or Montreal. And so I made arrangements ahead of time saying that I will need someone to take me from the gate out to the plane, like take me from the tarmac to the plane, to the stairs, because is it going to be bright out that day? Am I going to get lost out there? I don't know. So I made the proper arrangements and they forgot about me. They forgot about me basically. And I was just standing there waiting at the door to go out on the tarmac, like, okay, someone's going to come get me any minute now. And then I noticed they're closing the door of the plane. I'm like, I'm pretty sure it looks like that plane is getting ready to take off.
Oh, no.
It looks like, oh, no. What am I going to do? And I felt just so helpless in that moment. I was like, okay, well, if I miss this flight, it's going to suck. But I mean, that's life, I guess. But that was not a fun experience.
That is my biggest fear. And it happens so much when you get assistance in airports that they just drop you somewhere for the next person to come along. And I'm always worried about, is someone going to come along? Am I going to miss my flight? Oh, that's the worst.
The thing I hate most about traveling with a visual impairment, if you need any kind of assistance, or if I happen to have my ID cane with me, it's always different. It's like there's no consistency airport to airport. I can even go to the same airport 10 times and not have the same experience. They'll like make you sit down and take your cane, or you don't have to put your cane through the metal detector, or you do, or you can just take it with you when you walk through the thing.
Right.
It's different every time.
Yeah, it is. And I don't know, I find it particularly awkward in airports, the assistants. I don't know what kind of training they receive, but yeah, it's generally negative, unfortunately.
I'm kind of curious because I feel a little, how do I say it, like pressure to do this sometimes, but do you feel like you have to play into the stereotype of, and I hate saying this, but looking blind, I'm putting quotes around that, where in order to get help, or, you know, in order to not have, if you don't want to ask for help, you don't want to constantly be telling people, hey, you know, I'm visually impaired, can you help me? If you, you know, pull out your cane or wear sunglasses and you look more, and I hate saying this again, but blind, or what people assume blind people would look like in terms of the media stereotype. Do you find, like, you know, in order to get more help, you need to do that? Or I'm just kind of curious about that.
I think that it can be an effective way to more easily get assistance and have fewer conversations. But I would have to say I'm pretty wholeheartedly not for doing that myself. I think that that's exactly the thing that I want to get rid of. I don't want anyone to have to do that, because that's, in my mind, is ridiculous. We shouldn't have to play into the TV version, the movie version of looking like someone who's blind to to live in the world and treat each other like human beings when another human being needs help. And I don't mean to come off harsh. That is ridiculous to me that anyone should have to do that. But I'm not mad at the people who may choose to do that. And sure, like I said, if I'm going to a concert or a music festival or a busy place where I know there are going to be a bunch of people around and I might look lost or more inebriated than I am, I don't want something bad to happen. And I don't want to have to every 5 minutes explain myself. That is part of why I have an identification cane. But that I think is just being responsible in some cases, as opposed to living up to a stereotype, if any of that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. I think we should explain what an identification cane is, like what it looks like and why you would use that compared to sort of the regular mobility white cane.
Do you have one, Ishita?
I do. So I can really relate to what you're saying. And in instances at school, when it's dark outside or when I'm in a crowded place, I do take my cane out because I don't want people to walk into me or just to let them know I am visually impaired. So I totally relate to that.
I think that's a responsible way to use an identification cane or an identifier to let someone know what's up. An identification cane is a really small version of what most people know to be a white cane, like a long mobility cane. It's basically just a smaller version of that, a small skinny version of that. And you can fold it up, throw it in your purse, or throw it in your bag and take it out when you need it. That's kind of how I use it.
Yeah, so it's sort of when needed, not all the time, and you're not really using it to feel around in front of you like you would with the white cane that I use. It really is just to identify people that you have some vision challenges and in case you do need to ask for help, right?
Yeah.
I suspect it's confusing for people that don't know what that is, though. Like, why do some blind people have the big long white cane and others just carry this little cane? You know, are you a better blind person if you have a bigger cane or?
Well, that's a whole other conversation. That's the whole, are you faking it conversation or why don't you have a stick conversation? Mm-hmm. Please don't call it a stick. That bothers me. Mm-hmm. It's not a stick, but it that brings up a whole other conversation. Blindness is, like so many things in life, it's just a spectrum. It's just, we just need to accept that no two people are the same.
Yeah. I remember being, in that in between and, faking it in certain environments, but then needing assistance in other situations and almost like the guilt of like, well, should I figure this out on my own or should I be asking for help? Because I can see it's just going to take me a heck of a lot longer to do that. It is complicated. And then when you kind of add the perspective of, I don't know, society that doesn't really understand that spectrum, it sort of pushes on you as well.
I get where you're going. Like I spent a lot of years trying to just not acknowledge that I was blind or had low vision or had anything that I had to deal with. And that was so much because, I mean, the majority of that was just, I cared too much about what everybody thought and I couldn't handle the questions from, myself, like, should I ask for an arm? Like, vision loss and blindness are so, it's complicated. It's, I can run a 10 kilometer road race independently now. And then at the end of a road race one time, I needed someone to guide me down this huge staircase because it was sunny and I don't have any depth perception, to someone who just saw me running in that road race by myself, even though I have a bib that says visually impaired. I mean, to see me do that and then need help going down the stairs, it might be confusing.
Yeah. And the fact that you even have to think about that, like, oh, this is probably confusing for people seeing me, where I, listening to you, I'm like, of course, because on the mm-hmm. road, there's no obstacles. Like I always say, crossing the street is easier than walking along the sidewalk because there's no obstacles in that crosswalk, or there shouldn't be. So I get it. Like you can follow the crowd. You can run, you're on a road. There's not going to be a fire hydrant or something in your path unexpectedly, where this, you know, once you're done the race, the world is unpredictable again, right?
That's right. I've memorized that route in my mind. I know where all the turns are, and I've had someone drive it and tell me where the potholes are if it's a really unfamiliar area. So there's all this planning that goes into it. And I think I'm really hoping that people who, again, don't have any exposure to blindness or vision loss or albinism is the other big thing for me that I want to demystify. I hope that they come across our podcasts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned the terminology that you use, and I love it, because vision loss doesn't really apply to somebody who was born with a visual impairment. And yeah, the visually impaired versus partially sighted, personally, I don't like either of them either. And I think we do sort of just, you know, we choose the one that fits for us. But even referring to yourself as blind, I suspect there are people in the world who are really confused by that, even though legally you are, right? And the whole, yeah, just challenges around the language.
I think that's kind of their problem. But it depends. It depends on the day. I mean, some days I'm like, yeah, you know what? You be confused. That's fine. I don't really want to have a conversation about it today. But most days it's like, okay, let's have a conversation about it, because I would really love to just see, I'd love for everyone to just own the word blind and just understand that it doesn't mean one thing. In my role at CNIB, I have people asking me all the time, what's the correct terminology? What terminology should I use? What's politically correct? And I'm just like, I can't tell you that. That's a very individual thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that you say that, because for a long time, I started losing my vision when I was about 7. So blind wasn't a part of my terminology. And it was considered, I would say, like a taboo for a lot of the people that I went to school with. And they're like, you're not blind, you can see. So I shied away from using that for a long time. I would say, you know, visually impaired or partially sighted. And I didn't have a diagnosis for a long time until fairly recently, I think about last year. So I couldn't even tell them what I had because I didn't know. So it got very complicated when I tried to explain everything. But, you know, as I got older, you know, moved through high school and I started understanding that blindness is a spectrum, I became a lot more comfortable with saying, yes, I am blind because I am legally blind. And that's kind of how I identify. So, and it has made people uncomfortable. But again, I'm like, that's kind of a dumb problem than me.
You got it.
Yeah, I'm really happy that you say that.
Yeah, and actually, I love that. And I'm sort of comparing it to the autism spectrum, right? There is a spectrum there as well. So why wouldn't there be with blindness? And I think that's brilliant to think of it that way.
I'm very curious about the work that you do. I was reading about how you do journalism. So I'm very curious as to how your visual impairment either impacts that or just fuels your desire. I just very curious about how that works for you.
Well, I'll kind of start from the beginning of all that. I made the very intelligent decision to go to film school. And I say that jokingly. For a long time after I went to film school and I got my diploma, I was like, well, what am I going to do with this? This was a waste of time. I'm never going to make it in this industry. I had a really hard time coming to terms with that, because in school, I studied film and television production. In college, I could pick and choose the jobs that I could and could not do, either on the production side, the planning side, the directing side, behind the scenes. I could pick and choose the things that I could and could not do. But then when it came to the real world, trying to gain volunteer experience and any kind of real world experience in that film and television industry really kind of was a wake up call, a big time reality check. And I was like, oh, okay, I can hardly even be on a set because the lights are in such a way that I can't see where I'm going. I'm tripping over things. And it was, I think, probably a different environment than it is now. It's probably a little bit more accommodating, and people are a bit more understanding than they were like 15 years or so ago now. So that was really difficult for me to say, okay, that's not going to be my day job. I'm going to have to work a day job and maybe try and do some fun media type projects on the side. That was part of the reason why I had moved to Vancouver, and I've got a little tiny bit of experience there, but that's where I really had that revelation where I was like, wow, maybe I should have done something a little more practical, Jenny, and not film school. Maybe you should have listened to someone tell you that someone who's blind probably shouldn't go to film school. You know what? I don't think anyone said that. And if they did, I probably would not have listened anyway.
Right.
that's just the way I am. You know, it really all kind of came together for me. Like, I've been talking into microphones and making video skits and stuff my whole life. Like I said, I've been trying to make people laugh and entertain people because, like, that's the thing that I can do. I could never really, I didn't do well at sports, and the right accommodations and stuff weren't there for me. I was always more on the artsy side, and that's what people said I was good at. So that's what I did. And then I really only found my niche when I came to Halifax here. I moved to Halifax and I had been here for a little while, and I realized there's this place here called Accessible Media. How cool is this? And they make news accessible for people who can't read the newspaper. I was like, I can't read the newspaper. This is freaking fantastic. How have I not heard about this? Let me see if I can volunteer with them and maybe use some of these skills that I thought I might never use from film school. So I showed up there and I was like, hey, I'd like to volunteer. And they were just getting into the television side of things. And they're like, hey, we'd like you to maybe read for this hosting part. We'd like you to maybe try auditioning for this television show that we're putting together, which is still on. It's called AMI This Week. It's like a magazine, news magazine type show. Very entertaining stuff. Really great show. So I had the opportunity to get involved with hosting that show, which was all about bringing stories from the disability community to television in an accessible way. I learned a lot more about Describe Video and integrated Describe Video and how to use the right language. And I think that kind of came naturally. So I was like, really, my socks were just blown off that I had that opportunity, that I could do that on the side of my day job. And really, I've had this fantastic relationship with AMI ever since then. And they've afforded me all these really great opportunities. I've been able to host live from Studio 5 when it was that back in the day. It's been a really eye-opening experience, for lack of a better way of saying it. Cause I am so glad that this world exists, and it's really, we're seeing it in mainstream media now too. So long story short, Ishita, it was a rough go in the beginning, but I'm a tenacious individual. So I just kept, and again, it always goes back to, I think, having low vision. My whole life, I just keep trying things until they work, until I find what works.
Yes. Love that. Love that. Sometimes you gotta take a few wrong turns along the way, but eventually you'll get where you're trying to go. Right.
That's right. And sometimes it's about the process. I hate to admit it, but I learned so much from so many stupid mistakes and bad decisions, or they seem like bad decisions at the time, but you always usually take something away from them.
I agree. I just said that to somebody yesterday, just like, yeah, I don't actually regret any of the choices, even though they might not have been the right choices, because they got me to where I am now. So, yeah.
Jenny, did you go to like university? I think you mentioned that you went to university. I'm kind of curious about, like you said, accessibility. Because I was talking to one of my other friends who's also part of Blind Beginnings, Jill, and she is I believe she has only light perception. So her and I experiences are very different in terms of our accommodation. So I was curious if you could talk about your experience at university and what your accommodations was like, because I always feel like I have to prove that I can't see, or they assume that I can see a lot more than I can.
I'm definitely willing to talk about them, but I will say do not do what I did. I will preface it with that, because all throughout school, including college, I went to a technical college called Toronto Film School. All throughout those years, I had the attitude of, I don't need any accommodations. I'm going to be fine. I'm not blind. I don't need anything special. I'm just going to show up and do the work like everybody else. And that was difficult, to say the least. Difficult because when the times would come that I really did need some accommodation, like I really did in college need the notes from the board, or I really did need some kind of magnification software to use the audio engineering stuff. When it came time for those things, people didn't want to believe me because I had been flying under the radar up until then and managing, sort of using accommodations on my own that I didn't need to ask for, like handheld magnification and that kind of thing when I was studying. So I would say, do not do what I did. Take advantage of all the accommodations you possibly can. But I get to speak with people all the time who contact me at work, and they're wondering about, they're in post-secondary and they're having a hard time getting the materials that they need in accessible formats. And it surprises me to know that so few people know about the duty to accommodate, which is, again, another hard lesson I had to learn when entering the workforce, where I had to be like, okay, I really do need some help to get along day to day. If I'm going to have any kind of adult life, I'm going to need to accept some accommodations. And so I had to become a self-advocate very quickly. And I had some really bad experiences when it came to employment in terms of getting the accommodation that I needed there. So I can definitely appreciate it's probably similar now to when I was going through that, because I hear about it all the time. But self-advocacy is easier for some people than others. Part of why I ended up meeting Sean in the first place on that accessibility advisory committee is because I'd had these bad experiences asking for accommodation and not getting what I needed, despite going through all the proper channels and doing all the work I was supposed to do, getting the right documentation and that kind of thing. But it has been a challenge, and I would think if I would, and I know it still is a challenge, because a couple of years ago I tried to go and work somewhere that wasn't CNIB, and it's a big multinational bank, and they did not have their stuff together in terms of accommodation. Again, I had done everything that I was supposed to do. I was very upfront in the initial pre-screen interview about what my needs would be in terms of accommodation for the job. And that was a really difficult experience, because that, along with one of my first really bad employment experiences, was in front of a bunch of my peers. They were left with the perception that, what's wrong with this lady? She can't keep up, you know? Why isn't she moving on to the next phase of training with everybody else. And I could get into more detail, but I won't.
Do you have any advice or just any sort of, piece of advice for either youth or anyone who is navigating the world of low vision, how to feel comfortable in their own skin or just how to advocate for themselves who may not be very experienced in that?
I'm just thinking because I'm not one to give life advice, but if I could say one thing, it would just be, it all goes back for me to just keep trying different things until you find what works for you. My form of self-advocacy may not be the best approach for someone else. You may be a person that needs to connect with a professional or someone who has experience navigating that stuff. Maybe you need a hand to hold through your first couple experiences in self-advocacy. Just because you get a little bit of help navigating that stuff doesn't take away from the self-advocacy piece, I think. Keep trying things until you find what works for you. And it's going to suck sometimes. I tried so many different physical activities and sports and hobbies and activities. And I thought about so many different career paths and a lot of them didn't work out, but you just keep plugging away until you find what works for you. And that I think goes with advocacy too, because it doesn't always look the same for two different people. I'm really fine to speak up and speak my mind. And not everybody is like that. You don't have to be like that. You could put it down on paper. You could put it in writing instead. So, and the other thing is, please try the accommodations. Even if you think it's going to make you look different or stand out, do it anyway. It's going to be worth it because it might make your life a lot easier and you won't know until you try.
I think that's great advice. And I so appreciate you joining us today. I think we've had a really interesting conversation, but also interesting to hear about your life and the paths you've taken and where you're at. If people want to listen to your podcast, how can they find that?
Well, Low Vision Moments, new episodes come out the last Thursday of every month, and you can find it anywhere you find podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher. There's probably a few others, but those I think are the main ones. You can find it anywhere.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jenny, for joining us today.
Really my pleasure, ladies. It's been such a good, fun conversation, and I would love to do it again sometime, maybe.
That would be awesome. We'd love to have you back. Thanks, Ishita, for being my co-host today.
Thank you for having me again.
You've been listening to Limitless, the Blind Beginnings podcast. I'm your host, Sean Marcellet. If you have a question, a comment, a topic for a future episode, send us an email to limitless@blindbeginnings.ca. And please join us again next time.
This podcast has been brought to you by Blind Beginnings, an organization based in Vancouver, Canada, that supports children and youth who are blind or partially sighted, along with their families. Music for this podcast is composed by Sean Bishop and Clement Chow. Production and audio editing by Rob Minot. For more information about Blind Beginnings and the work it does to support children and youth who are blind and partially sighted, along with their families, visit us on the web at www.blindbeginnings.ca, and also remember to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We thank you for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you next time.